Cue Henry Mancini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome to the 264th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recordings for the previous 263 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C, so that's www.johnmack13.com. Then look under the radio show tab. In addition to the previous radio show, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe on only one email per day, and it's free. Writers in the Hudson Valley should be aware that every Thursday evening is the weekly meeting of the MAYAPAC Writers Group, now in its 21st year, at 6:30 p.m. at the MAYAPAC Library on 6th and Mahopac, which is the Indian pronunciation. More than 150 books have been published by writers from this group. Additionally, this Wednesday, February 13th, is the monthly meeting of the Mahopac Poetry Workshop held in the same MAYAPAC Public Library. Finally, this Friday, February 15th, is the monthly open mic session at the wonderful Hudson Valley Writer Center in Sleepy Hollow at 7 p.m. The theme of this month's meeting and the first theme meeting is Bloody Valentine, a call for readings around Valentine's Day. Pieces written may be romantic, erotic, power, or not related at all. People wishing more information on any of these meetings may contact me at johnmack13@gmail.com. That's johnmack13@gmail.com. For next week's show, I hope to be right back here at the same 7 p.m. Eastern time and every week thereafter. Now, to this week's show, as mentioned, it's on M64th. My guest is Rita Rusty Rose, poet, artist, playwright, vocalist, nurse, novelist, memoir writer, and activist. Wow, that's a mouthful. And we'll try to cover it all tonight. I haven't met Rusty in person. She was recommended to me by Therese Crane Birch, who's a regular listener to this show and has also been the person that recommended John Paul Wagner, Michael O'Keefe, and Teresa Dodaro, all Well, very good guests. Our listeners are wishing to join Rusty and me on the air may do so by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I generally hold call participation until near the end of my conversation with my guest. So let's get started. Welcome to the show, Rusty.
Thank you, John. I'm glad to be on your show, and hello to all of your listening audience.
How would you start us off with the poem?
I'm going to be reading Calvary. Tombs of Calvary dead glower at the Manhattan skyline of the living, their parched limestone and marble colophon crosses press shadows against monolithic skyscrapers as they toast to the future to be held by all. Erect obelisk soldiers stand sentinel, holding vigil, staring at the Gotham horizon. They shall lead the cavalry of sandstone and granite foot soldiers. Windswept and steady, they clench at the vast manicured lawn, silent and positioned on rolling green hills. Union soldiers, uniforms of copper patina, with cannon, axe, and rifle, surveil Manhattan to the west, Long Island the east, Brooklyn the south, Queens to the north, ready to welcome the fallen, awaiting drum and bugle call.
Wow. Thank you. For those who aren't familiar with the background, tell us about Calvary, to what led you to that.
Calvary is a cemetery that spans from Queens into Manhattan, and in between the cemetery is the Long Island Expressway. But Calvary was built around the time of the Civil War, and when the Confederate soldiers were kept, you know, prisoner, or they had to go into the hospital, you know, in Manhattan. If they died, they were, of course, brought to Calvary Cemetery. And my daughter is a photographer, and in her spare time, she takes photographs of the stones for people living out of state so they could be close to their loved ones, and she does this for free. And so I took the ride with her, and I could not get over the Confederate and the Union soldiers, how huge their monuments were. And I just sat there, and the stones all face the Manhattan skyline, and it is such a sight. And that's how I came to write Calvary.
Wow, thank you. Before we get into your history, where did the nickname the Rust come from?
My father and mother played tennis, and my dad, I have red hair, and my father wrote it on my tennis racket, and he put a Y instead of an I. I'm always corrected that my name should have an I, but I said, nope, Pop wrote it with a Y. So it came from my father.
Okay. Now let's go to your history. Where'd you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up in Bath Beach, Brooklyn, and I attended kindergarten to third grade in Brooklyn.
Do you remember what your earliest aspirations were?
I thought I was going to be on the stage somehow, because my mother had enrolled me in tap and voice lessons, and even in the theater at an early age. She had a cousin who was on Broadway in a play called Steam Heat, and her name was Carol, and she was the lead. And so often we'd go to Broadway, and Mom even had me in a few plays. I can't remember which one, but one of them I was singing Sweet Little Buttercup, and so that's all I can remember.
Were you an early reader?
Yes, yes. My, I love to read. My mother was an avid reader. My father, he was a businessman, but in his spare time, he wrote poetry and prose. And many times at night, my grandmother, with my grandmother present, we had kind of a salons, and we would all get up, and I would recite poetry or sing a song, and who played the piano. It was so nice.
That sounds very nice. Now, did your father ever publish, did he just write for himself and for the family?
No, he never got a chance to publish. Like, as we know, life gets in the way, and he had to work and support a family. And a lot of his work is gone now. I do have a few pieces, but most of it is gone. We had a horrific house fire in 2008, and we lost a lot of his work, my work, and like that.
Wow, that's too bad. We had the flood here in our basement back in October, and we lost the piano and the piece of furniture that was the secretary that belonged to my mother-in-law purchased in 1940, and we lost papers and that, yeah. And it could be worse, but
mm-hmm.
it's bad enough.
Right.
How about your high school years? Did you write for a school paper or for a literary journal?
No, not in school. You know, I wrote in my pastime. I went to the West Babylon junior and senior high, and Babylon is a town in Long Island, right in the middle of the island, and that's where I went. But no, I just wrote for myself, didn't get on papers or did anything in class with that.
Now, did you perform in any school plays or anything? Because I know that you sing and you're a bit of an activist. Did you do any of that?
No, not here. And at the time when we moved from Brooklyn, I was still going back into Brooklyn in my 20s until my grandparents died, you know. But no, I was kind of shy in school, and I didn't get a good reception when I first moved here. They kind of bullied me because I talked funny, you know, have that Brooklyn accent. And so I kind of stayed to myself.
Well, you're not now, so how about another poem?
Okay, sounds great. I'm going to read Nets for Bay, and that is a Blitz-type poem. It goes rather quick, and it's a tribute to Bath Beach, the place that I was, born and partly raised. This is Nets for Bay. Here it is. Hold on, John. Something happened here. We have a technical difficulty. Okay, Nets for Bay. I love Bath Beach. I love Brooklyn. Brooklyn Nets, Brooklyn Cyclone. Cyclone is a roller coaster. Cyclone in Coney Island. Island of Liberty. Island of Wonder. Wonder One. There's another Z in Verrazano. Wonder Wheel. Wheel and Deal. Mob style. Wheel Barrel. Barrel Ride at Nellie Bly's. Barrel of Laughs at Fun House. House of Cards. House of Brick in Brooklyn. Brooklyn Botanical. Brooklyn San Gennaro Feast. Feast on a Zeppola. Feast of the Dead. Dead Heat. Dead Night. Nighttime. Nightlife. Time to Ride the L. Time to Be Born. Born in Bath Beach. Born in Brooklyn. Brooklyn Bridge, Brooklyn Pizza, Pizza at L&B's, Pizza at Spumoni Garden, Garden at Prospect Park, Garden Flower, Flower Show, Flower Power, Power Walk, Power Talk, Talk Funny, Do You Think? Talk is cheap. Cheap is the price of a Charlotte Russe. Cheap skate. Skate at Rollerama. Skate through Dyker Park. Park at Fort Hamilton. Park along 27th Street by the bay. Bay forever gently flows. Bay inspires poetry. Poetry flows.
I love it. And you mentioned Fort Hamilton. My first job in technology, and I was a technology person for a long time, was at the Brooklyn Army Terminal at 58th Street and
mm-hmm.
First Avenue. Now, we used to go out to the Hamilton House for dinner sometime. So
mm-hmm.
that was a long time ago. And what happened after high school?
after high school, I was interested in singing rock and roll. I went to a school for I sang, and at the same time, I went to a college to become a funeral director, and also I went for nursing administration, and I hold licenses in nursing and in funeral directing.
Did you ever do any funeral direction?
Oh,
that's
yes.
Interesting.
Yes,
oh,
yes. Yes, I worked in several funeral parlors. And matter of fact, in Brooklyn, my uncle owned one also.
Oh, okay. And did you also do any writing while you were in college?
Yes, I did write, but you know, I didn't publish in any of the in the college papers or anything. No.
When did you begin singing professionally?
I was a teenager. I would say possibly 14, 15. I would spend my time in Washington Square or into the city, getting in bands. I even tried out for plays. One play, what is with Good Morning Starshine? I remember trying out for that, and I got the part, but I didn't take it. But
Good
I started
morning.
To Yeah, I
it
started.
It was sung by Oliver.
Right, that's what it was.
And Oliver, a friend of mine went to a wedding with his wife. And Oliver was related to the bride, so he sang at the wedding, and that was a big deal considered. Yeah.
Right, yeah. You brought that up. I do remember Oliver. It's been a long time. But I did. I got into singing with bands, and, you know, a young kid, oh, you know, you have a band happening here, and let's say you're in Washington Square, and we'd all go. And I wound up playing with the band at the Apollo, even the Fillmore East opening for, I don't know why, I think 10 years after, but I remember, you know, playing in different venues. And don't quote me, but I can't remember if it was Folk City or, no, the Bottom Line, I think, back when, you know. It was just something to do.
I used to go to the Apollo to rock and roll shows, and I saw Bo Diddley there, and I saw a whole bunch of people. And one of the strangest things that I had was I was in the balcony with three of my friends in the neighborhood. And as far as we could see, we were the only white people, definitely in the balcony, but maybe in the hall. And Bo Diddley changed the words of Who Do You Love? He said, "Tell me, Arlene, why does white milk make yellow butter?" Everyone turned around in the balcony, and they looked at us. And I had no idea what that meant. And he just kept singing, and he went on, and so they turned back around, and they kept watching it. And people have told me, I keep asking people, do you have any idea what this means? And the two things people have suggested was, it was a light-skinned black babies from white fathers and from black women. And that's the only thing I could think of.
Wow.
I never heard another answer. And then I used to go across the street. One of my favorite singers, Clyde McFadden, had a record store on 125th Street. So I used to go there and go home. But I love the Apollo.
I loved Apollo, and I have to say, I went there with my mother also to see James Brown. But I could remember this about me performing there. My manager was a black guy, and he said to me, "I want you to stay behind the curtain. I want them not to see you, but to hear you first." Because they threw tomatoes and they threw eggs, and, you know, or booed. And so that's what we did, and I can't remember what I sang. And then finally, you know, I guess he must have just told me, "Come on," and here I came, and they were like, "What?" And I got like a standing ovation.
That's great. You also, in your note to me, showed that you knew a whole bunch of very well-known stars from your singer, Janis Ian and Janis Joplin and people like that. So it must have been kind of a heady experience for a young girl.
Yes, I met Janis Ian. Janis and I discussed this when I used to go to my grandma's house in Brooklyn, and she was in a hall. And, you know, if you know anything about the halls back then, it was great echo to sing in. And I met her, and she was playing a folk guitar, and I joined her, and we became friends that way. And then many years later, and in the 90s, when I had seen her, someplace else, I was kind of embarrassed that maybe she wouldn't remember me, and I hung back. And then finally, when she saw me, we were hugging and embracing, and they were telling her, you know, like, you know, you had to keep a distance between the security didn't want us to embrace, but I was so happy she remembered me. And I met Janis Joplin many times, but the one memorable time is, again, I was singing in Greenwich Village, and then we went from McDougal Street to hanging out in the Chelsea Hotel. This guy Bobby had a place there, and she was standing in the front and everything, and she was sweet, we hit it off, and I hung out with her in her room, and everybody was running around the halls there. And from that point on, when she came to town, I would announce that I was there, and I would go backstage. And the same thing with Richie Havens, Johnny Winter, up until he died, we were friends, and also Marty Balin from the Jefferson Airplane, who just died.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, we exchanged Christmas cards for many years.
Janis Ian had that great song, At 17, that was such a terrific song. Yeah. During that time frame, you also became involved in the famous incident in New York City's Stonewall Inn. Please tell us about that and how you wound up in the middle of it.
Yes. I'm considered now the mother of modern-day LGBT movement because in the 60s I helped fight for civil freedom at the Stonewall Inn, which was a club in Greenwich Village.
And how did you happen to be there? And did you get hurt, or did you get locked up, or did anything happen to you there?
No, I did not get hurt. I did, like, skin my knee, but nobody really got hurt that night. And in retrospect and looking back, the police really weren't interested in us, per se, you know. But I wound up there because there was this lesbian who we call the drag king, and he would put money in my little hat when I'm sitting in Washington Square singing and playing a guitar. And then later on, I met him on McDougal and Bleecker, and he asked, would you like to go to this club with me? And so we walked. It was my first time there. I avoided like the plague. I've been there only 5 times since then by request of others. But we weren't even there like an hour when the place was raided.
And did they give any reason then why it was raided, or was it just because of the clientele?
Well, I didn't know at the time, but over the years I'm told it was a altercation between the police and the bar owners. I think it was about permits or something. They didn't hold the necessary paperwork. But what happened is I was kind of in the middle to the front of the bar in that area with Vinny, and there was a, at the time, called a tranny, not transgender. We were still, you know, all discovering who we were then, and, you know, you didn't have the right acronyms and things, but and she was at the bar, and looking back, I could say that she was the age I am now. I'm almost 68. So she wasn't a young transgender person. And then there was this black drag queen, and she wasn't in drag. But you knew by you know, the way they spoke and the way they looked. Like, for example, the transgender woman was very demure looking, very reserved, where the drag queen was kind of garish, you know, her movements and all that. And they came in, and I could see hands, a few cops, you know, like I call them flatheads. They were in plain clothes. They came in. One went behind the bar. You could see the bar person leaves, goes near the bathroom, and then the hallway. The arms are flying, and now I see another one, and that cop said something to the effect, "We're going to take this joint." But at the same time this is going on, before the cop said, "We're taking the joint," he called us faggots and poofs and, you know, like that. And the jukebox was unplugged. The lights went on. It seemed like it was surreal. It was quick. It didn't happen for hours. It seemed like it came and it went. And they start asking us for ID, and I did not have ID on me. Some kids ran out, and then I saw uniforms, and now you couldn't get out the door after that. And they started to ask for ID, and a few were let go with ID, but I was in for the long haul, and I was thinking, oh, my God, what is my father and mother going to do? That's all I could think about is my mom and dad.
And did anything happen? Did you get taken away, or did you get a...
Oh, goodness.
Did you get sent?
Yeah, well, the Vinny that I was with, they tried to cuff him, and they actually grabbed because... they felt, well, if you're a female, you need to wear a bra. And they felt that the transgender woman should have on an undershirt. And they didn't. And they wanted them to go to the bathroom. And there was like a tug of war here. And they tried to cuff Vinny. And at the same time, there was pounding at the door. And the cops started to take the stools. And they said to call for backup. And they put all this against the door, and we started to shout and go forward, and they told us to get back. And finally the doors opened, and we kind of scuffled. They were pulling Vinny, and then they had him on the floor. I jumped on the back of a cop. I grazed his eye. I'm not so proud of that, but then he shook me off, ran up 7th Avenue, but to my surprise, there were horses there, wooden horses, and I couldn't get out. And so he grabbed me by the collar and, oh, how old are you? Where do you belong? And, of course, I tried to, you know, look all innocent and said, I'm from Long Island. And I don't think he was interested in me. He said, well, go home. He says, go home. And so I ran past the stone wall, and I somebody told me to head back to Washington Square, and I did. Some people put Band-Aids. I remember Band-Aids on my legs, and I stayed a while, and then I took the train back home.
You were worried about your parents finding out. Did they find out that you were involved when it was on television and everything?
No, I didn't breathe a word about it, and I don't think really anybody did, unless you bought the New York papers. I don't even think it even hit the Long Island papers about this raid. So
it was on television.
No. Yeah, I didn't mention
it. It was on television, though, I remember. You know, there was a story about it, like on Channel 4 News at 11 or whatever, you know. But
well, I'm sure that I was on a train and didn't see that. And, you know, I was really shaken up with that. And I was in a lot of protests and things and of that nature. But this was like my first rebellion, my first raid, being face-to-face with the police. But like I say, looking back, they really were after the bar owners, and when they were put in the paddy wagon, I have to say this, as they were trying to put my friend Vinny into the paddy wagon, which they succeeded, when I was coming back, the policeman told me to go home, it was like the Keystone Cops, except for a few that were, now I don't know if they chained people to the paddy wagon, but for the few that were sitting in it, everybody was going in it, going out it. It's like they were putting them in, they were going out. That's why I say I think they were reluctant to really arrest people. But the bar owners were the first ones they took out, and we followed them.
The only paddy wagons I ever saw regularly, I used to go out to Rockaway during the as a teenager and that. And on 103rd Street, there was two Irish. There was the Leitrim Castle, and across the street there was Nicky Carton's Mayo House, where a terrific Irish singer named Ruthie Morris used to sing. And they used to park the paddy wagons right in the street. So when they tumbled out of the Leitrim Castle, and they could just throw them right in the paddy wagon. It was pretty funny.
How
about... Go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. I interrupted
you. No.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
How about another poem?
I didn't hear that.
How about another poem?
Oh, sure. And I'd like to give you a little background on this. It's called Transcending Generations, and it was in the 2018 Beatitude, which is an anthology that comes out every year. And it's Transcending Generations about my father and Jack Kerouac. And I didn't get to tell you, but beside being a businessman, my dad would do odd jobs like painting and odds and ends. And it would take us, you know, from Brooklyn to Shelter Island and then to Northport. And Dad was doing a job for, I think it was his mother, Jack Kerouac's mother. And we got to walk with him to the bar. And the funny thing about him is he would wear these pink girly slippers. And that's all I remember, you know, about him. So just a little background. I just wanted to say that. and this is the poem, Transcending Generations. On the road in his pink girly slippers and Japanese kimono, Canadian club in hand, snapping his fingers to jazz, he saunters to Washington Square Park. And on a converging road wearing fringe moccasins, I trot along McDougal Street, browse head shops along Bleecker, humming a popular tune. I then come to rest on a boulder just beyond the men playing chess in Washington Square. I strum my folk guitar with resolve. Mushroom to enhance creativity, he offers. I sing the blues all the while, intrigued by him in his black shades, black Japanese kimono, black beret, and roll of nickels bulging from pocket. I am charmed by his toe-tapping in feathery pink slippers, bopping head and finger popping. He exclaims, "Good beat, man, really beat." His shy eyes study my psychedelic hippie threads and seed beads. "Groovy, man," I reply, plucking a 12-bar beat. He raises paper cup to my lips. I swig the sweet whiskey. He flashes his blue eyes. "Beatific, man, you wail. Nickel for your thoughts." "Heavy, man," I reply, "far out." And hand in hand we stroll, beat the gravel to burn like a yellow Roman candle.
I love it. And you brought back memories. I read... On the road, when I went down for the summer job at the Parks Department at the Arsenal in Central Park, and I didn't get the job, but I walked across and I walked down to get the 8th Avenue subway at 42nd, and there was a McCann's bar, and McCann's, when all of the beers cost 15 cents in bars, the McCann's used to cost 10 cents. So I went in the bar, and I sat there, and I read On the Road in a few hours, drinking 10-cent beers. It brought back that image.
Did you get a meal?
No. I just sat at the bar reading the book and drinking beer. When did you begin writing for publication, and what was the impetus to finally be published?
I published, gosh, I could have been in my 20s or 30s in a press down south. I was in local papers, but I wasn't so big in submitting, you know, much. I actually did this poetry and everything for my own enjoyment. And along the way, my friend who was a screenplay writer and a Tony Award-winning writer, Leslie Lee, he was a professor, and I wanted to go to school for literature and poetry and everything. He said, "Oh, no, really don't go." And he told me, "I don't want you tainted. I want you to stay pure to the art, because then you become a hack like everyone else." And so I didn't go, you know. But I published, I must add, little stories. My mom may have submitted them when I was 12 or 13. And then in my 20s and 30s, I would enter a contest here and there. But it wasn't until I met, I had a chapter in the early 90s published, but I didn't go full swing into it until I met James Wagner. And he saw value in my poetry, and he kind of resurrected me and a lot of us. Because at the time when I, before James even was born, and but poetry groups on Long Island wasn't so receptive to certain people. They stuck to a certain style, and, you know, so it wasn't until James and Gems Press, you know, did I really start putting all my stuff out there.
In addition to your poetry, you've written for a wide range of platforms, but let's start with your nonfiction, semi-autobiographical, Asylum from the Inside. Please tell us about that. How did that come about?
Okay, I was a short version. I was a psychiatric nurse, and I worked with patients, and I was appalled about the treatment of them. And then the administration on Long Island put a guy on my ward. They failed to screen him. I was told years later that I was set up, which I was in shock when I heard that. But I was strangled and beaten and left to die by a patient who wasn't screened properly by the administration. And while I was recouping, I wanted to purge myself of what happened and all the horrors I saw with the patients. And I wanted to put them in a good light and give them the respect that they so deserve. And so I wrote Asylum from the Inside, which is an expose about the maltreatment of the patients and how I come to, you know, to get hurt. And I can tell you that without even trying, my book was picked up by Richard Kohler, who made Battlestar Galactica, and he optioned it. Then my friend Leslie Lee, the playwright, and rest his soul, he died 2 years ago, he got into it. He absolutely loved it, and he wanted to reshape it, and we began a treatment for television called, and for the big screen, called The Family. And then Toni Mendez, who was a literary agent in Manhattan, she got involved, and she wanted the literary rights here, and she wanted foreign rights, and then there were toy makers, and for, what do you call that, the CD games, you know, that the kids play today. And there was so much going on. And in the last hour, I pulled the plug on the entire project. And I pulled it because I asked the magic question. I wanted in my contract to say that the patients need to be kept in a good light, and me too. You know, my name is fictitious in the book. And they said no. They were thinking about something about a cuckoo's nest. And there was also an actress called Celia Ward. I don't know too much about her, but Richard Kohler wanted to jump that he needed a vehicle to jumpstart her career again. And so much was going on, but with that, and plus I was naive with all, and I had an entertainment lawyer, with all these people around me, I wasn't guided either, you know?
But you are coming back to, aren't you re-edited? Or is the project dead?
I say I let it to God and I let it be out there. You can get it in any country. You just plug it in and everybody could get a copy of the book. But I never thought of resurrecting it. I did have offers from people who wanted to make it into a play or a movie. But they said that I would have to help them get write grants. I never wrote a grant in my life, and that's not my cup of tea, you know. And so I just, you know, I let it ride, you know. But right now I'm working on, you know, something else. Mm-hmm.
You've also completed work on a suspense thriller, Return to the Grave. What's the background on that, about that work?
Yeah, I say Return to the Grave is cooking. When I write something, I won't look at it for like 3 years or more, and then I'll sit down and read it as if somebody else wrote it, you know. And it's about a cancer agent getting into the water supply. It's about a mega storm, and there's so much going on with that one. And I wrote it because I had a girlfriend who died of multiple myeloma, and she was being experimented on, and that's why through her efforts and everything, you have a stem cell treatment. But it was very rough for her, and, you know, it was horrifying what she went through. And it started out as just writing something about her, and I just kept writing and writing, and it just turned into something I would imagine, you know, but and then there's zombies. I was writing it before the AMC show, The Walking Dead, but everything, you know, it's the water supply is tainted, the aquifers, people that are deceased, it's saturating them almost. It could just saturate through the even in the morning fluid, and they're rising, and the people who are just dead are rising, and it's I just put it down for a while, but it is complete, and eventually I will it is copywritten, and eventually I will put the book out.
Perfect. And this year you mentioned that you're going to begin at another play on the No Pun Intended. What is that?
Yes. Years ago, I directed and helped write a production for a friend of a one-woman show she was doing in the past, and she called me to write a screen treatment of her life and a play. And she chose me because she was familiar with my work in the past. I said, I'll give it a go, and I actually finished it, and that's in my quotes. It's cooking too. I have to let it cook, and then I read it, and then I edit it, and then I will give it to her. It may be on or off Broadway. So that's, I just have to, you know, look at it and finish it. And that's it's a story of her life, because she is also like me. She wore many hats. She's a sculptor, an artist, she tangos, and I had to put everything about her life together, and then I had to, of course, embellish. You know, you have to tie it in somehow, and so it's like a kind of Dolly-ish. It's a dream within a dream within a dream. It's very complex. We're going to need a lot of stage sets for this.
Now, back to poetry. How about another poem?
Okay, I will read you Fire Island Light. And if your listeners don't know, we have the Orient Point on the North Shore, and on the South Shore we have Montauk Point, but right in between Babylon and Islip, right in the heart of Long Island, we have the Fire Island Light. And this poem is about how the lighthouse will be standing there forever when we're gone. And so this is Fire Island Light. Drifting on a raft within the vast Atlantic, sun-weary and thirsty, recollections like waves in full trundle crash against my cushioned brain. As I see you, I hold on, I am safe within. Sun-bleached and faded, your thick umber casing nears. Like cement statuary, it grips the ground day and night. The wheeling of light searches blackness, its silver shimmer illuminating ghostly clouds. Sun rises and sunsets hide behind you. They exhaust the billows until they burst, but I hold on. I am safe within. And up the primordial lighthouse stairs, a dark iron spiral I do climb, one and then another. A youthful tribute to each step of my life, though much longer than mine. I hold on, I am safe within. I focus on sea mist and stars, they leave me unsighted, and I inhale the salty air at the top of the catwalk, reaching for the slippery rail. I see naught, but can hear the ebb and flow of the swilling breakers, and I am in awe. I hold on, I am safe within. O wondrous island tower, you shall forever exist, mortar and brick. Centuries of impenetrable moss have sheltered plaque upon your cracked walls. Like old sea bones, they batter and cling, but you hold on, I hold on, I am safe within. And thirsty and wearily I drift upon the Atlantic. I am leaving now. Adieu memories, all is ending, and I see naught. But I can still hear your clacks and moan as the worn gulls squawk. Yet I hold on. I am safe within.
I love it.
Thank you, John. Thank you.
Leaving the world, the writing for a short bit, please tell us about your art. How did you get into it? What did you study? And where have you exhibited?
Oh, yes. Well, you know, like I mentioned, I have a lot of artist friends. And I, even from a child, my father loved to paint, you know, not only canvas, but he painted anything he'd get his hands on, like in the yard. If he had pink paint, everything would be pink. But Dad loved to paint statues and everything. And I feel that it was a medium that I'm not threatened by. I just did it for fun. And because I had a lot of friends in it, they put me in their shows from here to Soho to Manhattan. And I call myself a dabbler, but my medium is acrylic. Oil takes too long to dry. And I favor surrealism and abstract. I took classes with a friend at Cooper Union in Manhattan. And also, my paintings are in an art magazine in the MoMA, New York. And another person I met in the 60s was Andy Warhol. And I attended some of his parties. So I got to see that. And I even watched Yoko Ono do her cut piece. And I forgot what she called it. She had four people dressed in black on each corner of the street. And then they would cross. I forgot what she... But I was always had friends in the art. And then I met in the 60s. And I adore her. And she just died. It was... Dr. Stella Pandel Russell, who was a legendary artist and professor of arts at Nassau Community College. And she gave salons in her home. And she also taught me privately. And I had six salons there, but she was an inspiration for me to paint, so to speak.
Now, with the poetry writing and with the art and with the editing of the play and everything, how do you organize your time? To what is your main focus, or do you try to divide it up among all these different things?
Well, I like now, I have a book coming out, and the editor, I met with her the other day, so I allow time for that. But mostly, I think, like Oscar Wilde, he talked about procrastinating. I feel like I'm the world's greatest procrastinator. And if I wake up in the morning and my heart is filled with poetry, well, I'll dedicate the day to it. If I itch to start painting, you know, on a canvas, I'll do that. Right now I'm between everything, but I have no a set schedule for anything, except that now that my book has been edited, I have a book called Veranda Sundown that's going to come out with Local Gems Press during the year. And also I'm working on a project called Stonewall's Legacy, a book of LGBT community poems, again by Gems Press. When I have to be, you know, have to put my nose to the grindstone now to get this book out, then I have to sit there and painfully, you know, do that. But this is why Leslie Lee said he didn't want to taint me, because, you know, and this is why even in mainstream I never tried to, in quotes, make it, because I can't write a book or do something because someone is telling me, go ahead, we need this out today. I don't feel that you could have somebody dictate to you when you do your art. I couldn't live like that. So I wake up in the morning and whatever happens, happens. But like I said, now, because I have to begin editing, I'll be starting this week to do that. And plus, I know in my mind I have to deliver that play, no pun intended. So these two are on the front burner. And like I said, with the art, if I feel overwhelmed by it all, I just go on a canvas and just paint. That's my relaxation, because I don't have to be good at it.
You mentioned earlier to me off the before we came on the air that a number of years ago you had a stroke. Now, how much did that impact your work? How much time did you lose, and all the things that you now do?
Yeah, well, it does affect me in a great way. Sometimes, like I'm writing and everything's come out jumbled or backwards, and my editor, she'll tell me that, you know, is this what you mean? I have a left side of the body weakness in my left mouth, and I struggle harder than most, and that's why I wrote the Blitz poem, and I recently wrote one for Gertrude Stein, and it's like a lesson in how to articulate again, you know. And it, I was in a hospital for a while, and you know, home for another duration, and I was also in my day, I was a physical muscular rehabilitation nurse who worked with stroke patients, like, for example, how do you tie a shoe with one hand, or, you know. So I tried to apply what I learned years ago in you know, forcing this on myself. But I know with a stroke, it's one day at a time, and all I can do is the best, you know, that I can do. And I always am in fear of having another one, because once you have it, you feel like a Russian roulette wheel. You never know when the next one is coming, you know?
Wow. Now, as we move into the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall incidents, you've been very busy with interviews reaching as far as London and Sweden, and you've been named Poet Laureate of the Long Island LGBTQ community by the Huntington Cinema and Performing Arts Center. Tell us about all this. What's going on with the anniversary, and how much does this take away of your time, or how much has it been something to write about, fodder for your writing?
Mm-hmm. Well, I do have a poem. It's in that Quartz article, A Lesson on Civility from the Stonewall Riots, is an excerpt, and I can't, you know, do it now because it's really long, and it's about the Stonewall, you know, rebellion. But it is a time-consuming because it's the 50th anniversary of what I was a part of. There are many people coming out of the woodwork. I've been interviewed by Sweden, London. There's one in the works, and I'm not allowed at this time to say who and what, but it is going to be a series made for television, hopefully, but it's still in the works. And people are just, I've been asked to be interviewed, and it's very stressful. And one thing that we're arguing about, those of us who are alive, there are not many of us who were at Stonewall that are alive because, you know, I'm 68. A lot of people were older than that. And what is happening now is that the New York City Pride March / Parade has been marketing about the Stonewall. You know, they're all gung-ho with Stonewall. But yet, those of us in the organization that I'm in the Stonewall Rebellion Veterans Organization, we've been writing letters to them, when are you going to recognize those of us? Because they are failing to make those of us who were there the grand marshals this year, and rightfully so. This is our time. And it's all about the corporate dollar, which upsets me, because it's taken over, you know, everything. And then there's another group, Reclaim Pride. And the Heritage of Pride, the first one I spoke about, they shortened our route. We used to march up Fifth Avenue, let's say, for argument's sake, let's say 50-something Street, all the way down to the Washington Square Arch, and then we cut to Waverly, make a right, and then, you know, cut left to Christopher Street to the Stonewall. Well, now they're just like, what, marching a few blocks to the Stonewall. And so we're having a little disagreement there, but Reclaim Pride wants us to march the entire route from Fifth Avenue. But however, though, as it is now, I do have my Cadillac or Pontiac. I'm accounted for, but which one are we going to march with? I wanted to tell everyone that we should march with the New York City Pride, because I don't want to give them the satisfaction of pushing those of us who are pioneers out. It's about what we did. And they would not exist if it wasn't for our efforts. So there's a lot of stress.
That's a very good point. Yeah, I'm sorry it's wearing on you. Once again, back to poetry. You mentioned the book. You have a collection of your poetry coming out this year. Give us the title again of the book.
It's going to be called Veranda, like sitting on a veranda. Veranda Sundown.
Veranda Sundown. And when do you expect it out?
Well, I'm right now, I just received, you know, the edits, and now I'm going to look it over, make the necessary changes. And this is, what is this? This is February. Probably, I'm hoping by the early fall, or maybe before that, because we also have the project of Stonewall's Legacy, where I and the publisher invited all LGBTQ community and even the straight community to submit poems about, you know, Stonewall, or knowing someone who is gay, or even being LGBT themselves. And so that's in the works. That one is supposed to come out at the same time as the parade in June. So, yeah, so much to do, so little time to do it in.
short time span to get something out, out by June, I know by experience. Last year, you also received an award from the Bard's Initiative for your contribution in the Long Island poetry community. Tell us about that.
Oh, I didn't expect that. At Walt Whitman's birthplace, I was given an award for outstanding literature from the Bard's Initiative, and I was very touched. And at the same year, I received 2018 third place for Super Poem Sunday, and that was for Nets for Bay, the one about my birthplace. And I was very honored and touched that all my peers thought that highly of me, and so did Local Gems Press.
Yes, James Paul Wagner, operation. As I mentioned, he was on the radio show a good while ago. What's next for you?
Well, next for me is a lot of edits, a lot of wrapping up the play. I hope it'll go on Broadway. The books, hopefully, they'll be published. And then I have so many things to try to finish. And what's next for me is, I know, coinciding with the Stonewall 50th, a very fabulous artist, Anu Anam. She's from India. She's usually a watercolorist, but she did an oil painting of me, and it was presented at the Huntington Cinema and Performing Arts, as well as when I said I was deemed the 2018 LGBTQ Poet Laureate. And that's amazing. So she's going to take that painting of me during the time of the celebration of Stonewall, and it will be showed in Soho galleries and in who knows where. Hopefully the Modern one day, or the, you know, or someplace like that. But she's going to travel. It'll be a traveling exhibit.
It would be great if you could use that as the cover of one of your books.
You know, I didn't think of that. I'll have to credit you with telling me that, John.
Yeah. The Stonewall book, for instance, yeah. We've covered a lot of bases tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about Rita Rusty Rose?
I just want them to know that, you know, that if you want change, you don't just sit around in the wings. You know, you just got to grab those wings and fly. And I want to tell the young people today, the millennials, that we need to do things peacefully. You know, I don't agree with all this that's going on today in the world. There's a peaceful way. In the 60s and 70s, all right, we had our moments, but we did things in a peaceful manner, and I just hope that they, you know, do that. But you know, what keeps you young is that you keep on going, and that's what you have to do: keep on keeping on.
As a bookend, would you take us off with another poem?
Yes, I'm going to leave you with a little light piece that the children and the teenagers like. It's called Art is But a Poet's Dream. Art is but a poet's dream, to make one feel, to make one sing, to make one express an inner glow, to explore each self for the world to show. Art is but a poet's dream, strokes broad and thin, in a vision sprouting to light, the scribble of words to one's delight. Art is but a poet's dream, a kaleidoscope of desire, mediums of paint and ink fleeting in a blink. Art is but a poet's dream, indulging in who I am, to daub the universe as I see fit. Art is but a poet's dream. Do not wake or rattle me, for I do not want imageries to flit. Art is poet's dream, the color of the craven soul, to have forever and to hold. Art is but a poet's gold.
Dream. I love the repetition. Very often that doesn't work in a poem. That worked very well there. That was extremely well done.
Thank you, John. And thank you for having me, and thank you for the listening audience listening.
Rusty, thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
And send you any comments. Too. I hope to hear you from you again.
You will. Send any comments or questions to me about the show at johnmack13@gmail.com. And be sure to join us next week at the same time. Go to my website, www.johnmack13.com, for the URLs of previous shows, all 253 of them, and the schedule of the upcoming shows. And in other words, the Mets radio announcer, Howie Rose, after the Mets win, put it in a book. And until next time, and as they used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Let's go off with the Eagles. Amazon, play Peaceful Easy Feeling.
Here's Peaceful Easy Feeling from your library on Amazon Music.
Thanks again, Rusty, and good night, everybody.
Good night.